We're doing the Chazon Ish. We're up to the 11th section of the first chapter, and the Chazon Ish was describing how one who can break from his desires, one who has the tranquility to look at the world, will see a phenomenal order in the world. If you just analyze the science behind our own bodies, the eyes, the ears, you look at the science of how man was created, you see a tremendous order. And then he said that there is a tendency in man to like lies. We enjoy hearing lies, we enjoy telling lies, we enjoy exaggerations, we enjoy fantastic stories. There's a tendency in us that we enjoy lies. It's hard but important to discern between the fictional parts of history and the non-fictional parts of history. There's a fine line between what is imagination and real, and that's a line that's easily crossed. When a person can attain a true understanding that there is a creator and he is running the world, then there's a certain pleasantness to life. There's a happiness that enters him, and then his imagination and his knowledge can work in sync in understanding God's ways in the world. It gives him a lot of strength. And the Chazon Ish then went to discuss that when it comes to all kinds of intellectual sciences, we say there seems to be no connection between a person's traits, a person's midot, and a person's intellectual capacity. It would seem that a person is a good mechanic, irrespective of whether he's honest or not, irrespective of whether he's kind or short-tempered. But the Chazon Ish said that's not so. In truth, when it comes to many forms of wisdom, when it comes to understanding certain delicacies, certain intricacies, certain refined parts of a wisdom, there, if a person is more refined, he will have the sensitivity to discern that delicate aspect of the wisdom. Whereas a person who is unrefined, whose traits are more crass, will not have the sensitivity and will not be able to understand and perceive certain aspects of the wisdom. And so that leads us to the 11th section. Yesh ish mitave lehitiv lezulato. You have people who have a strong desire to do good unto others. Hipakshoim re'ehu hu lo lechedvat lev. And when they meet a friend, that's cause for celebration. They're happy to meet another person. Mekablo v'sevar panim yafot. When he sees his friend, he greets him warmly. Chared ulai lo kala la'matra lefi ruach re'ehu. He is thinking as he is speaking to his friend, as he's connecting to his friend, maybe he's off. Maybe he's not exactly behaving the way his friend would like. Ulai dibel davar shelo kohogen. He thinks about his behavior. Maybe he said something that's improper. Ki en kev lev etzlo kakev shel pkiya bechvod chavero. Because this kind person, one of the things that would bother him most is the thought that he hurt his friend's honor. Or that maybe he withheld something from his friend he should have offered. And this person who is so kind, he isn't offended because he has so much love that even when someone does something offensive to him, the love will smear over, the love will embalm, will soothe over the pain, the fact that someone else hurt him. You guys don't know what I'm talking about. It's a theoretical person the Chazon Ish is talking about. I don't know if anyone here ever in their lives experienced such a thing. I'll tell you when you experience it, when you have a baby. And you're changing the baby's diaper and the baby pishes in your face. And you don't mind. Doesn't bother you. You don't hold it against the baby. And when you have a child and you give him a candy and the child says, "Nah, I don't want that." And you look at him and you say, "It's so cute." Is it really so cute? Or is it just that you love the kid? So the time that we actually get to experience this is when there is a child that we really love. Then we can handle this. Notice that as the child grows older, you have less patience for the child. You have more expectations. The love takes a different shade. You have a person who is so kind that he is willing to accept the pains that their relationship might entail, and he has enough love that the love can overcome all of that. Because a person recognizes that most people do not have such refined traits, so what can one expect from them? Let's take a simple example. You'll get married, and you'll suddenly feel like your wife doesn't have the traits you're accustomed to. So for one person, it comes to play when his wife shows up late to every date, and then shows up late to the wedding, and then continues to show up late in life. And then where he comes from, this is unacceptable. Another person has to deal with the fact that his wife doesn't clean dishes well. You know, so takes the dishes out. No? Oh, they're still dirty. The wife has to deal with the husband who puts his floss down next to the bed, takes off his socks and leaves them next to the bed. Didn't she ask him 1,000 times to put them in the hamper? So, these are real examples, but they're not good examples. Because, in truth, these aren't examples about traits. These are examples about bad habits. A real example about traits would be, let's say, person gets married and discovers that his wife is sarcastic. Person gets married and discovers that his wife yells a lot, even though he doesn't yell, or vice versa. So, this approach is an idealistic approach. It's the ideal approach. If a person can attain such a high level, if he can have such true love. We know two types of people. We know a person who stands his ground, and we know a person who has a weak nature and does not stand his ground. He's not talking about either one. He's talking about someone who's healthy and has healthy love, and he's so healthy and he has so much love that even though he's aware of what's happening, he lets the love smear over it, and he can deal with it. I can say that in my lifetime, I think I merited to see one person like that. Very big Talmud Chacham. Maybe two. One I think I saw it on, another one I don't know, but I would like to think yes. That's all. Maybe a third. When I think of the Talmid Chacham I was zochet to see, I remember one Talmud Chacham. A few times people did things that I thought were very offensive, and I saw his approach. It was like, maybe he didn't notice, maybe this. He was able to, very smart and very sharp, and also very willing to forgive. Maybe the person didn't realize this, that, and the other thing. Very, very sharp, and still very forgiving. And it stemmed from a true Ahavat Yisrael, a love of Israel, and a desire to be able to see someone positively. But very sharp. You saw it when he gave his court rulings that he was able to see through everything. I think for most of us this is like an imagination. We're talking about an imaginative figure. And even though a person feels like other people do not have his refined traits and they're definitely capable of hurting and his love will overcome it, his heart senses honor for them. He respects them. And his heart doesn't even have those thoughts of scorn towards other people. He doesn't look down at them. One of the hallmarks of a very refined and developed soul is that a person can be focused on being a source of good for the world. Now that's a level to aspire to, that a person will be a source of good, of imparting good onto others. And the more a person can focus truly on doing that, the more he can develop the other traits he discussed. Gam bishnefachim benoseh echad, veliot ma'ashim et atzmo al kol shal, al chisron ha'shlemut b'sgulat ha'midot, veliot mezaket achiv zchut gmura u'muchletet, av im kabot ha'galachat ha'av. Two opposite sides. Meaning on the one hand, he holds himself to a very high level. If he said something that might have hurt someone else in the most minuscule of ways, he holds himself accountable. And yet when his friend does things that are so crass, that are so blatantly wrong, he's willing to overlook it. Notice, we tend to work the other way. You know, the other guy, we hold him to a very high standard. And ourselves, we're willing to overlook many things. The Chazon Ish says, no, the exact opposite. You develop your soul, if you can really connect with God, and this is the build-up here. From emunah, he's building up to where does a soul that has emunah, where does it grow to? It grows to a point that it is a source of blessing to the world. A source of blessing to the point where it's not offended. It can see things positively. It can overlook other people's shortcomings. It can impart kindness, not because it's stupid. It is very sharp and it discerns what's right and wrong, and yet that soul is willing to forgo, and it has so much love that that love will cover over the inadequacies that other people have. Yakir ha-nefesh dinan, this precious soul of ours, eino doresh menafsho hitapkut yetera v'chagirat sherit koach neged haragzanut hativit. It's not a situation where the soul has to constantly hold in the anger. There's a natural fury brewing within, but the soul has to keep putting down that anger. It's not that the soul has to keep telling itself, don't get upset, don't get embarrassed, I know they embarrassed you, but don't hold it in. Because the soul has been refined to the point, it has been so cleansed that it doesn't get hurt, it doesn't get soiled, doesn't get dirty. That soul is on a level where it's always happy. And so it has a continuous, eternal pleasantness and happiness, a certain tranquility with which a person goes through life. And I said that a person should go see big Talmidei Chachamim because this is one of the hallmarks that you see. I said, you have to come to Merkaz Rav to see Rav Avram Shapiro because you see a man that's smiling. You see a man that's radiant with joy. One of the greatest lessons I found from being around people who were big was that they're pleasant, they're calm, they're tranquil. You know, the Chazon Ish who wrote this, you know, he had a great sense of humor. You know, his students once came to visit him and they were learning and they needed a break. And he said, okay, let's go to the roof. They ran away from his wife. His wife used to terrorize his life. She was like always careful that he should rest and they shouldn't bother him. And so they go up on the roof and he says, let's have a tug of war. So they grab two ends of the string and they start pulling. You know, they're pulling all the students against the Chazon Ish, right? That's what you'd imagine. The head of Bnei Brak, who's such a huge mind in halacha, is having a tug of war with the students. And at one point he let go of the string, so they all went flying across the roof, right? And they all burst out laughing. That's not what they were expecting from the Rebbe, right? There's a story about how the student came and his wife was busy taking care of him. She was an excellent wife. She ensured that he lived out his life. You know, one of the jobs of rabbis' wives is that they watch to make sure that the students don't sap every ounce of strength out of them. They make sure that they actually live. So his wife was doing just that. And so the student couldn't get in through the front door because the rabbi said, no one's bothering my husband now. So he's walking around the house, and the Chazon Ish was sitting in the back room on the back porch, learning. And he sees the student, and he sees him pacing, and the student is scared to say anything. So he looks at him, and he calls him, and he says, what you doing? So he says, well, I have a question. So there was a fence there. So the Chazon Ish tells him, you're wearing your Shabbos pants. So he says, no. So he says, no, so what's the problem? Jump! You know, come over the fence. The student jumped over the fence, climbed up, and they sat down and learned until the wife caught them, right? there are many stories. The Chazon Ish was filled with life. He was a youngster at heart throughout most of his days, yet he learned with great ferocity. His student once came into the room, saw him lying on the bed, and the pillow was like a little bit further than an arm's length from his bed. So he asked the Chazon Ish when he got up, why didn't you take the pillow? So the Chazon Ish said, if I would have had strength to get the pillow, I would have learned a little bit more and then gone to sleep when I didn't have strength to get the pillow. By the time he hit the sack, he didn't have strength to reach out and pick up the pillow. But it's true. That's how hard he learned. He was a tremendous mind who learned tremendous amount and knew a tremendous amount and knew it in depth. A super genius. And yet, he had a pleasantness and a joy of life and a happiness. He's describing something that he lived. And I merited to see it by quite a few giants in different places in Israel and the United States. It's one of the things you should see when you have an opportunity. Go see Big Talmidei Chachamim, but see them in a real setting, not in a play setting, you know, like when they have 5,000 people looking at them. Go see them in their home setting, and you'll see people filled with life, filled with joy. I don't think there was rarely a time, I can't remember a time, that I asked Rav David Feinstein a question that he didn't answer me with a joke. You know? Every time he'd tell me a joke and give me the answer. And it didn't contradict anything. Didn't take one iota away from who he is. Because that's part of life. To be able to have that sense of humor, that tranquility, that joy, that happiness. But that comes with a certain tranquility that stems from the connection with Hashem. I said this here before, that I think that living life without God is one of the most sorry states a person can be in. I don't know how a person can find peace in their life if they don't believe in God. Because at the end of the day, there is so much to life that's out of our control. We don't control. We don't control our heart. We don't control our health, our children's health. The fact that we don't understand God is an issue. But if we recognize that He's running the show, then we can live with that issue. I don't know how He's running it, but I'm going to do my best. He gave me a system. I'm living by the system. Now I can live with the consequences because He's running the show. It's not my responsibility. But if there is no God, then it's all my responsibility and I can't control it. It's a very scary world if it's all on my shoulders. Then maybe I should run for prime minister, president. Maybe I should try to put a stop to Iran's nuclear weapons. Maybe I should do a lot of things, because if there's no God, then it's up to me. So I better do everything. Yeah?
I think you can take the opposite approach as well. If you don't believe, I know lots of people who don't believe in God, and they're quite happy and content and they're not afraid because they say, everything's random. Nothing is happening in my life because I'm doing this or I'm being punished or whatever. They're free. And whatever happens, happens. And it's chance, it's circumstance, and they sleep very well at night. Whereas the people I know who are religious believe in God, constantly are wondering, what do I have to do to get out of the doghouse? Why am I being punished? Whereas they're more psychotic than the people who have no belief in God, because to them, it's all random. There's no meaning or purpose or I'm being punished or anything like that. They just live their lives. They're not tormented like religious people tend to be.
So I think it's a pity that if religious people are tormented, I think that that's people taking things too far. So maybe after we finish the Chazon Ish, we should learn another work. Remind me. There is a psychologist, he's still alive, who wrote questions to the Stipler, Rav Kanievsky's father. And he compiled a book of the answers the Stipler gave him. And one of the things he addressed was this issue, that people will sometimes be very uptight in the name of religion. It can be obsessive compulsive disorder, it can be other things, but there's this tendency that people will very often take their psychological issues and do them in the name of religion. Like Rav Feinstein once told me, if a guy gets out of bed and checks that his front door is locked 3 times before he goes to sleep, then it's not that he's so pious about religion, it's that he's nervous about everything. Okay, so then when it comes to religion, he's also nervous. So I definitely think there is that element, and there's definitely people who take it out of whack, and there's also a misconception where people think that to be pious is to take things to a level that's not piety. It's just not right. I think If a person lives life where everything is random, I have to wonder how they deal with the hardships of life. Because if everything's random and meaningless, so then, I don't know, how do you deal with hardships that come a person's way?
Because it's random. It's easier.
Why is it?
Because as opposed to saying, I believe in God, whatever system I'm operating, because if you're sick, examine your ways. If this happens, examine what you're doing. You could drive yourself crazy.
You could, but you shouldn't.
Said it, but if you are within the system says, if something is not going or is affecting you negatively, you have to stop and say, okay, what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? Where am I? How am I with God? That's very
demanding.
It's demanding, but I was going to say it can be very nerve-wracking. Whereas if you don't believe in God, and there's a vast amount of people that don't, they wake up in the morning, they have their breakfast, they go about their daily lives, and they don't keep wondering, why is this happening, why is that happening? Things happen.
But
they don't spend a lot of time worrying about it. Whereas people who are within the system spend a great deal of time worrying or thinking about why this is happening, why that's happening.
Doesn't life lack meaning?
No. I know lots of people who are not religious in the smallest sense of the word. And they have friends, they have work, they have social circles, they play music. That's the meaning, they don't feel that it's empty.
But only as long as everything is going well.
No, I know people who have tragedies and sick kids and whatever, and they say, why not me? I mean, it happens to cancer wards are full of sick kids. It doesn't mean you're a good or a bad person or God's unhappy with it.
Right, but again, that doesn't mean...
Earthquakes happen, it's dumb. So you don't worry about it. How do you control it? So things happen. You have to take it personally. Don't take it personally. Life isn't so complicated that way.
Although there are so many institutions, most of the sort of tendency that when things happen that are horrible or too much, too big, then they turn around and couldn't deal anymore.
Yeah, there's no refuse in fossils.
I also...
It's so complicated, whereas religious by definition is.
I agree that there are complexities. I agree. Yosef Dat, Yosef Machov. Mm-hmm. And the more you know, the more complex it becomes, and that's not easy. I agree that in certain ways, the cat that lies in the sun and spends its day doing nothing but enjoying the sun has an easier life. I don't know if they have a meaningful life. I kept asking you, does life have meaning? And you said they play music, they go to ballrooms, they have friends.
They go to earthquake zones and help out.
Fine. I didn't say, you know,
life
but still. Okay. Okay.
And I'm working with a whole group of people now who wake up and know about their lives, and they're no happier or no less than we are.
I don't think so. Let me tell you a story. We had a student here. It really struck me. I once thought like you're saying now. We had a student here. I don't know if it's fair to say his name. He was a professor, and he made Aliyah. And then his documents weren't yet recognized, so he joined a faculty of a top university, and he joined their research program. Okay? 1 week he doesn't show up to class. Okay. So I see he doesn't show up, and he was pretty steady, and he wasn't feeling well the week before. So I figured, okay, he's not feeling well, he's out. When I realized it was a week that he hadn't shown up, so I stopped class one night. It was like a Monday night. I asked the students if anyone saw him. No one saw him. Instead of going to class, we all went searching for him. We called. There was no answer. His cell phone was off. We searched, and we searched until about 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, continued the search at 5 o'clock in the morning, and at about 10 o'clock, we found his body. Okay. So then they took his body to Abu Kabir, and we had a whole legal fight to release his body to get him buried. And we notified the professors he was working with. And then we finally, it was Tanis Esther, we finally went to court and got a release on the body. The professors call me up and they say they want to know what's going on. They'd like to get his part of the research that he's been working on. And these are very humanistic professors. This is, I mean, they were working in the humanistic departments. And I called them up and I say, you know, they tell me he's very well liked here. And I say, okay, so we're going to have a funeral procession tonight. He has no family. There's no one here. We'd like, you know, if you guys would show up, it would be very nice. For sure. We'll let the whole faculty know. Okay. Out of a whole faculty, how many people do you think came? In Mahon Meir, we had every person who knew him and half knew him, including girls from Mahon Ura who somehow were connected. I don't even know how. We had over there, I'd say, about 200 people on a wintry, rainy night, just after a fast, from the religious circles here in Kiryat Moshe. How many people do you think came from that faculty? Guess, you know, there were about 30 people who knew him. How many people showed up? It was inconvenient. It was night. It involved the drive. They had cars. We came by foot. It was rainy. How many? Guess. Try 50. I think that when a person lives a life without an ethic, a person is always serving himself. Even his donation to the Red Cross. In a certain regard, I want to live a life where I'm doing this. I feel very good about myself. Guys asked me about 5-6 years ago, what advice would I give to Bill Gates' daughter? It's a question on a Thursday night. So I said, I think that she has to volunteer. Because otherwise she'll feel worthless. If she tries to make more money than her dad, tough luck. It's not likely. You know, if she tries to get a better invention than her dad, not likely. So if she's going to live the world the way the Western world lives, she's always going to feel like a loser. Because next to her dad, she's like a wannabe. Like, she's not going to get anywhere. If she adds meaning to her life, then she might feel success and she might actually walk out a sane adult, you know. But even that, she's serving herself. Chesed leumim chatat. The Talmud says, yeah, the nations will sometimes do acts of kindness. The question is, who are they looking to help? Yeah, very often there's this feeling. I volunteered. I went and served a half a year. You have to wonder, is there real meaning? How much of it is really, I'm doing something for someone else. I'm doing it because I want to add meaning, like you said, when I asked you if they have meaning in their lives. I didn't ask if they do good things. I asked if they have meaning. I don't know if that's called having meaning. If life is random, so you're a good animal, okay? There are other animals that help. You know, life loses its meaning. Life loses its sanctity. Life loses its value. If I'm just another animal in the animal kingdom, so it's a question of survival, okay? And if I do something, that's very nice of me. But I have a hard time, in all honesty, I don't know if I wouldn't commit suicide. I don't know what value life has. That's value. Why does that have value? Helping people has value. If there is no God and there's no ethical system and there's no moral system. We're doing the Sfat Tamim. We're in the middle of the footnote. We're on page Chaf Aleph. And the Chafetz Chaim had been discussing that our tendency in this generation to pursue luxuries, what he calls the luxus, the luxuries, is very detrimental to our way of life. People end up entering debt. People feel like they have to compete with the neighbor who has this luxury or that luxury. So
he's talking about our time.
He's talking about his time, but it's just as relevant in our time. And luxuries have destroyed many people, says the Chafetz Chaim. Even people in our country. First issue we have with these extra luxuries is that it destroys the relationships between man and his fellow man. People become accustomed to living a life of high expenses. Once people get accustomed to that, it's very hard to come off of that. It's very hard to go down. So what happens? A person says, I got to make that money because this is the lifestyle I'm used to. And then people allow themselves to do things that are dishonest in their business because they got to make an extra buck. And people allow themselves to deceit and do things with cunning and all kinds of excuses that people make up for themselves. And the reason is, a person thinks there's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. He says, what do you want? You want me to be out on the street? My family, I need to pay my medical expenses? He doesn't look at his other expenses. You know, he says, I got to live up to, you want me not to buy medicine for my kids? Wait a second, but what else are you spending on? Person calls me up. They really need certain medication and they can't afford it. So we call for a meeting. I come to their house and I see all kinds of American cereals sitting on the fridge. Like expensive cereals, they're paying 30, 35 shekel a box. And as we're sitting in the meeting, the air conditioning is working full blast. I don't even have air conditioning. And they're sitting with air conditioning going full blast. And I have to wonder to myself, what's going on here? They don't have money for the medication they need, but they have money to buy 30 shekel a box cereal? They don't have money for the medication, but they have money for the electric bill of running the air conditioning? What's going on here? So what happens is a person allows himself, he figures, come on, I need the medication. He doesn't think about all the luxuries he's spending his money on. And what happens is a person ruins future generations as well. And it applies to his relationship with God as well. Because what happens is a person feels like, I can't live without this. So he views life through that prism. How can I manage without this? Person thinks he has to live in a large size apartment and all kinds of amenities. He needs the same level of life for his children. A person thinks to himself, a regular business, it's not going to last necessarily to help my kid. How do I help my kid have this type of lifestyle? In ancient times, a person looked for a school and he said, where will my kids grow up to be the best human beings? Where will they get the best Torah education? A person says, yeah, but my kid, if he's going to live up to this level of this financial level that I'm on, he's going to need more skills. I'm going to send him to a different school where he's going to learn finance better. Let me teach him secular studies better. Let him know languages. Let him know medicine. Let him know geometry. And then maybe he'll be very wealthy, even if my business doesn't last. It's well known that you put a kid in that environment, you're putting him with people who desecrate Shabbos, people who very often view other prohibitions of the Torah as irrelevant. And very often a person finds his own kids in the same attitude. Because those are his friends and he learns from them. And why did the son end up in such an educational system? Because his dad wanted to give him all these luxuries. So this is what we want to explain. That sometimes what happens in our day and age as well, people make the luxuries into necessities. People spend money they really can't afford. It hurts them financially, emotionally, economically, religiously, socially. People are hurt in so many ways, yet the luxury becomes a necessity. And then people view the rest of life through that prism. Everything else has to revolve around this question. I can't afford to lose this luxury. And that's why the Chafetz Chaim went on and on for pages now about the importance of recognizing that luxuries are just that. They're not necessities. And that a person has to be careful because a person can very easily get swept away and then it carries a huge price tag. So all this, now this last section was a quote. And he says, whoever is going to listen is going to listen. What would be a similar example? I'll tell you, credit cards today. So some people use the credit card to pay their electric bill and their water bill and their gas bill. Certain things which you generally use in a certain amount. Hopefully you don't leave the lights on for nothing, etc. But then some people, if they have a credit limit, let's say 5,000 shekel, so then they finish off their salary plus the credit limit this month. Why? Because if I want it now, why shouldn't I have it now? But why? I'm already paying what I haven't yet earned. And what'll be next month? That's not a way to live. So I'm looking for the luxuries. Why are they so important? ואפותם אנשים שלא עזבו מקומם ולא קלקלו פניהם את דרכיהם, אבל כמה ביטוטרו התפילה נגרם להם בגלל המותרות. החפץ חיים says, let's say you have a person who doesn't go to that extreme, okay? So, he's not destroying everything in his life for the luxuries, but nonetheless, you do have to invest a lot of time in this. שהיו נאלצים לעבוד שעות מרובות ביום, לפעמים אף בלילה, כדי להרוויח כספים עבור המותרות. People spend a lot of extra hours working day and night in order to finance those luxuries. You know the story about the Mexican fisherman, right? You have this big businessman who goes on vacation to Mexico. And he's lying there on the beach. And the first day he sees a Mexican fisherman come out with his big sombrero and cast out his rod. And after about 5 minutes he pulls in a fish, puts it on the side, cast out his rod a second time. 5 minutes later he has a second fish, takes in these two huge fish, puts them on the side, goes, lies down under the sombrero for another few hours, and in the mid-afternoon a kid comes by and he gives the kid the fish, and another 2 hours later a kid comes by and calls him home and he goes and enjoys the fish with his family. So this businessman sees this happening day one, day two, day three. By the end of the week he's already pretty friendly with this fisherman. They're sharing the beach together and he's going out of his mind. He sees this guy after 10 minutes spending the rest of the day under his sombrero. So he looks at the guy's house, and he looks at the guy, and he looks at the kids, and they're all wearing the same clothing every day and everything. So, by the end of the week, he says, pal, let me ask you something. So the fisherman says, si, senor, yes. He says, why at the end of each day, you know, you spend 10 minutes, you get two big fish. Why do you stop working? So the Mexican looks at him and says, why not, senor? He says, well, look, if you would fish more, you could fish all day, you could start a business, you could sell fish, see, and then what? He says, and then you could sell the fish and make money and build a big business, and then what? And then you could have trucks that sell your fish and make your business bigger, and then what? He says, and then if everything's successful, you could be like me. You could come out here to the beach and enjoy life. So the Mexican says, but I'm doing that now, you know. I fish my two fish and then I go enjoy life. Right? So we aspire to many things and we don't notice how much we have to invest for that. How many extra hours we have to work. I have a friend who was in education until this year. This year he couldn't continue in the place he was teaching and he didn't find a different place, so he had to leave education. He went into high tech. He told me he comes into the job in the morning and he works the hours he's supposed to and then he gets up to leave. And all the other people at work look at him like he's crazy. They say, why aren't you staying extra hours? And he says, why should I stay extra hours? And they say, you'll make more money. And he says, I don't want to make more money. The salary I make from the hours is fine. I have a family and I want to learn Torah the rest of the day. So he gets up and leaves and he tells me at work, they all look at him like he's crazy. He says, everyone thinks I'm nuts. Everyone stays extra hours. Everyone makes more money. And I don't. I hate the hours I have to spend there. I wish I could be teaching instead. I didn't find the job. Okay, so I'm making better money working in high tech. But the second I could get out of there, I go back to the base of Medrash and I learn. I go teach my kids. I go be with my family. And everyone thinks he's crazy. Chafetz Chaim says, even if a person didn't destroy everything, look at how many hours he spends trying to get luxuries day and night. What's happening to life? Where's a person's set hours for learning Torah? A person doesn't have set hours. Does a person make it to Beis Medrash to learn? Does he have a set chavrusa even at home? Look at a person making a blessing after he eats. Suddenly there's no time. Look at a person davening. The average person is spending his life in a rush. What are we rushing to? Think about it for a second. What would happen if you'd work an hour less, 2 hours less, and you took more time, provided you don't spend it on the internet, guys, right? If you waste time on the internet, then you won't have time. Then it doesn't matter how much time you'll have, you'll never have enough time. And when a person has that sap that he has acquired in yeshiva, it can get all dried out when a person is spending his life rushing to try and make another dollar. And a person can become more and more materialistic as each day passes. And you see this in life. You see this. What?
It's everywhere. I mean, even in yeshiva, you try all the day busy to learn everything. You cannot learn everything.
Agreed. Agreed.
Unless you're trying to reflect, help somebody.
Agreed.
To pray. Everybody run away and don't pray because they became tired after they pray in Shabbari. So everybody, you every morning you see how hard it is to put somebody to pray.
Agreed. Agreed.
Everywhere is such kind of... For money it's worse because from this perspective.
Agreed. I think that in general, we live in a society where we've destroyed our value of time because I think a large part of it is that we have watches that are correct to the minute. So we start looking at time as down to the minute or the second or the millisecond or the nanosecond. And so we enter a realm that's much more pressurized. And really the human being has a hard time dealing with such pressure. So it's much more healthy if things are more flexible. You know.
It's kind of trick. You just try to play in my school what I learned. Only for example, the entire 2 years of learning. So before that I learned in other school that we have 15. And the level was lower than here. You have 4 exams, and it's so I think that to do a few things sometimes is better than a lot of.
I agree.
So you're saying it's better to do less, but do it more thoroughly?
Very often. We live in a day and age where the norm, the tendency is to up the pressure. We have this horrible term called overachiever. And I don't know if that's fear. I would say it's over pressure. Let's achieve what we can achieve. Why do we have to overachieve? We have to achieve what we can achieve. Why are people sitting here awake at 5 minutes to midnight? You know, if you're enjoying the learning, fine. But if you're doing it out of pressure, goodbye, get out of here, go to sleep, go for a walk. You know, life is to be led in a manner where we're exerting a healthy amount of effort. Not driving ourselves crazy. There's no reason for it. The Torah lifestyle isn't structured such that you should be pressured when you wake up and pressured every living waking moment. No. There's no reason for it. There are moments which are like that. At a time of war, every second is pressure. When a person's in the middle of a medical operation, every second is pressure. When there's a medical emergency, every second is pressure. But most of life should be lived at a normal pace. There's no reason for it. You're right. Erev Shabbos, the final hour before Shabbos, is always filled with pressure. And even that, if a person works hard enough at it, then you can get to that also with more tranquility. I have a friend who gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to a 7 o'clock minyan. And he always says, I get up at 5 so I could go to 7 without pressure. He takes his shower, he sits down and drinks his cup of coffee, he learns whatever he wants to learn, and then he goes to shul bright and early. He gets to 7 o'clock minyan. Okay, that makes sense. The average person wants to go to 7 o'clock minyan. He wakes up at about 5 to 7. He leaves the house at 7:05 cursing why he didn't hear the alarm clock 10 minutes earlier. Shows up to shul 10 minutes late. He's wrapping up his tefillin, trying to mumble whatever words he can get in so that hopefully he's going to get somewhere Shmoneh Esrei. When everyone's about finished Shmoneh Esrei, he's trying to catch in his Shmoneh Esrei. And then he stumbles out of shul and asks himself why he didn't shower before shul this morning, wondering if he's still going to have time to shower before he has to go out to work. And, you know, his whole day looks like that. Many people's lives look like that. No, that's... Torah is very happy that we should lead healthy, calm lives. So, to be continued.